and welcome to the Q York podcast, brought to you from our local church in the beautiful city of York in the UK. The message you're about to hear is from one of our services, which also feature great live music and relevant movie clips. These can all be found on our blog, so to make sure you're getting the full experience, feel free to head over to qyork.co.uk and select blog to find the relevant content. There's also a huge selection of talks and live music videos on our media page, as well as a donate button if you'd like to show your appreciation and enable us to keep producing free content like this. Finally, to stay up to date on new blogs and events at Q, you can sign up for emails by filling in your name and email address at the bottom of any page on the website. But right now, it's time for the message.
So today it's quest part two, and I've called it in the theme Curiouser and Curiouser. And as you can see, it's a quote from Alice in Wonderland. What it actually says is, "Curiouser and curiouser," cried Alice. She was so much surprised that for the moment she quite forgot how to speak good English. So I almost call the talk Curiosity Killed the Catechism, because clearly curiosity pushes us beyond manuals of belief. But I wanted to actually be more positive about it. And just by way of placing myself in this, this is quite personal, because basically what I'm talking about is where I've emerged after being in a very different place for a long time. And it was only after my entire belief system disintegrated, not necessarily all my beliefs, but the system of belief disintegrated, that I ended up in the place that I'm going to talk about. So this is not, it's not ideas from a book. It's not the result of some research. It comes very much from inside me and the experience that I've had. So if you weren't here for part one, why? Let me summarize. Actually, let me put my glasses on. So last time we explored how philosophy tries to justify beliefs, and we also discussed how our brains resist a change of belief, but eventually update our model of reality. We look briefly at the ideas of Michael Polanyi, who proposed that our beliefs are dynamic and are formed and reformed over a lifetime. This happens as we immerse ourselves in our subjects, use our intuition, and get validation from the community. He also argued that knowledge is practical, and so it's more like being able to ride a bike than knowing the physics of riding a bike. And so part one was very much about the mechanics of believing. And today is about what fuels our believing, what fuels our curiosity, what are our sources of belief, and how should we engage with them. And I'm going to use the term sources of knowledge. And by that, I mean books, films, YouTube, documentaries, online sites, podcasts, talks, courses, art, music, ChatGPT, tours, exhibitions, museums, and all the other things that I've forgotten. We've never had access to so many sources of knowledge. So when I use that term, it could be anything that we interact with in order to learn things. But first, probably my favorite clip of all time. I love that clip because it sums up about 85% of all discussions I've ever been in, where people are debating between things that they have never seen. And how do we avoid the blue stone of Galveston problem of talking about things that we have no actual knowledge of ourselves. Well, I've got four principles, if you like, of what I'm calling critical curiosity. So it's the way I'm suggesting we might want to think about being curious. You can make your own minds up. But here we go. Number one, engage with the primary rather than the secondary source of knowledge. What do I mean by that? Well, I spent decades where any subject I wanted to know about, I read a Christian book on it, preferably by someone who I already agreed with. And so I was absolutely stuffed full of second-hand opinions on everything. However, I have learned the hard way, and very late, that the experience of actually reading the original book, or watching the controversial film, or speaking to someone about their actual life experience is a much more powerful and authentic way to engage. Sometimes the only way to see if the blue stone of Galveston or the Infanta's eyes are bluer is to look at them both. I'm hoping now we have a blue stone of Galveston, do we? We do. That's the blue stone of Galveston. It's the actual blue stone of Galveston. It doesn't exist. So the first thing is engage in the primary sources, and I'll come back to that a bit later on. The second thing is remember that sources of knowledge are not neutral. Could we have the next slide, please? So curiosity did not kill their cats, as you can see. These are three French continental philosophers. I'll talk about them in a minute. But during the Enlightenment, we had this idea that knowledge could be objective and neutral. But since then, we've really questioned whether that is true. And we've started to realize that knowledge has a context, has an agenda, has people and institutions behind it. And although they might not wish anybody ill, all knowledge presented to us has bias associated with it. Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud were collectively known as the masters of suspicion, and they ended up with a hermeneutic of suspicion, basically suspicious of every source of knowledge, looking for hidden meanings and knowledge. Ironically, all three of them established systems of knowledge just as big and ideological and intricate as the ones that they were suspicious about. But later, the continental philosophers, oh, I can see it on this side. Later, the continental philosophers built on their ideas. Jacques Derrida, who's the one in the middle, argued that language is layered, words are ambiguous, and there's always more meaning than can be contained in any one interpretation of anything. And he called for the deconstruction of literature, politics, ethics, and culture to really dig into all that complexity. Just for completeness, Foucault, who is the one on this side, because I'm seeing them the other way around, linked language with power, saying that the people with the power tend to determine the meaning of language, and we should be suspicious of that. And then the other one is Deleuze, who came up with this term becoming, which we often use at Q, this idea that we're all becoming or in becoming. But they basically taught us to have a healthy suspicion towards sources of knowledge and to know that they are set in a context. And that doesn't mean that we have to take it to an extreme, as some of them did, to say that all meaning is subjective and we can't enter into meaningful dialogue, because I think we already know that that's not true. But equally, we shouldn't be naive about the things we interact with, and we should question them and be critical of them. So that's number two. Number three, seek out diverse sources of knowledge. In his book, Radical Curiosity, which my daughter bought me for my birthday without knowing anything about the Q theme, it just arrived in the post. But Seth Goldenberg recommends diverse exposure to sources of knowledge. He suggests that reading is the cure for fascism and travel is a cure for racism. And in philosophy, this openness to diversity is often called the embrace of the other. And it generally makes us feel really uncomfortable. And I'm going to come back to that in the next segment. But then finally, we should engage the sources of knowledge together. Polanyi talked about a shared quest. And the simplest forms of this exist in our society, things like book clubs, you know, where we take something and we engage together, because there's something about being together that's better than doing it on your own. And during the Enlightenment, these coffee houses emerged in which philosophers, writers, politicians, scientists, business people, and critically, ordinary people, it was not an elite thing, met together and talked about all the subjects of the day over a coffee. Stephen Johnson has got a new version of this that he calls liquid networks, focused around innovation by bringing together different sorts of people to collaborate. And I think Q is in that kind of tradition of the coffee houses and the liquid networks, this bringing together of disparate points of view, hopefully to innovate in our thinking. So, engage in the primary sources. Know that knowledge is not neutral and we shouldn't be naive about it. Seek out diversity and engage together. Those are the four things. But now it's time for the next clip. I don't know if you ever saw it, but basically the entire premise of the series is Carl and his typical sort of Little Englander mentality. And he's not on his own. Arturo Casadevall, I almost tried to pick someone else because that was so hard to say, but he's the person, he's a professor at Johns Hopkins University, and he talks about how specialism has created a system of parallel trenches. And so a lot of experts are very narrow as well, and our society is full of specialization. Anyone who's had anything wrong with them probably has experienced this in the health system, how you get passed from specialist to specialist until they actually figure out what's wrong with you. And if several things are wrong with you together, it's a bit of a nightmare. So David Epstein, in his book Range, encourages us instead to capture and cultivate the power of breadth, diverse experience, and interdisciplinary exploration. So how can we do this in the quest? Well, I want to briefly talk about two historical things and then a quick personal story. Can we have the brain, please? Thank you. So first of all, I want to talk about a fight. It's a philosophical fight, and it carried on for 1,000 years. So this is the debate between rationalism and empiricism. Don't worry. So this is a heavyweight. This is a heavyweight fight. In the blue corner, we've got Plato, Descartes, Karl Popper, and their motto was, "We think, therefore we are." They argued that knowledge comes from an intellectual intuition. It's what we call deduction. In the red corner, we've got Aristotle, Francis Bacon, and David Hume, and their motto was, "A wise person proportions their beliefs to the evidence." And they were the empiricists. They said true knowledge comes from the senses, and that's what we call, induction. So after slugging it out for 1,000 years, someone had the idea of maybe doing both. And that is what we now call science. Because what we do in science is we take a rational intuition, a hypothesis, and we test it empirically to see if it's true. Fortunately, though, it just took 1,000 years for someone to decide that maybe there was a best of both option. And science has not learned from its own history, because so often science has become scientism. If you add an ism, as I'll come back to, if you add an ism, something happens. And of course, the claim is that science is now the only source of truth about reality. Michael Shermer, who's the founder of the Skeptics Society, so no friend of religion, actually notes the similarities that he sees between scientism and religion, including a cult of personality. David Bentley Hart says this, just amuse me. He's singling out physics with some sarcasm, and he says this: "Physics explains everything, which we know because anything physics can't explain does not exist. Which we know because whatever exists must be explainable by physics, which we know because physics explains everything." So what's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is combining things can be very powerful, but it's really easy to just fall back into our trench. And anyone who comes from any form of fundamentalism knows all about trenches. So that's number one. Number two, the polymaths of the Renaissance. So the Renaissance period between the 14th and 17th centuries. If you were in the monarch's court, you were expected to speak several languages, play a musical instrument, write poetry, be conversant with philosophy and theology, know about current affairs. Now, of course, they had the time and money for all of that, and you might say that you have neither. But think of Leonardo da Vinci as probably the poster person of the Renaissance. He was a scientist, engineer, inventor, musician, architect, and writer. I'm not sure what he did in his spare time, but that's what he was doing for work. And of course, there's other so-called polymaths: Alan Turing, Isaac Asimov, Blaise Pascal, Isaac Newton, Michael Polanyi, who I've been going on about. And you can think of modern equivalents, whether you like them or not: Elon Musk, Stephen Fry, famous women who don't get the exposure in history that they deserve, Marie Curie, Ada Lovelace. These are people who mastered multiple disciplines. Now, we probably don't have the time, money, capability, or inclination to be like them. But I'm suggesting this morning that maybe we could be polydabblers. Maybe we could do something as simple as take a book on a new subject on holiday, or listen to a podcast on something we've never considered before. In my own small way, I've become a better technologist because I've been reading about philosophy, and I think I've just become enriched by the fact that as recently as last year, I tried to get into poetry for the first time in my life, thanks to Frank Skinner's podcast, which I recommend to you if you're like me and poetry's not been your thing. He's an amazing user-friendly guide to the subject. That was so other. To me, it was untrue, but I've got a lot out of it. But now the personal story, which is not about poetry, it's actually about my personal quest into sacred books. You say, what are you talking about? Well, I think I might have told you this before, but when I was a child, I got into trouble for taking one bite out of every item of fruit in the bowl. I think, Danny, just seeing, is that what you used to say when you did that kind of thing? I actually found a machine called a polyfruit, and I think I was the prototype for that machine. I'll explain why that's relevant in a minute. But I was told other religions were demonic and I should not have anything to do with them. And I no longer believe that that is true. However, it did not stop me when I decided to engage in this, feeling some mixture of anxiety and fear as I did it. You know, our programming runs very, very deep. But I did do it. And of course, I was full of second-hand opinions, Blue Stone of Galveston style, on all of these things. But my method, by the way, was to listen, because they were mostly audio books, to listen to the whole introduction so I actually understood the context of each religious sacred book, and then to sample as much of it as I felt like I needed, so I had a feel for it, which in some cases were quite big chunks and in some cases smaller. So far, I have sampled the Quran, the Bhagavad, I can't say it. They call it the Gita, but the first bit is the Bhagavad Gita. The Upanishads, they're both from Hinduism. The Tanakh, which is our Old Testament, but I looked at it as a Jewish book and not as a Christian book. The Pali Canon from Buddhism. I read several of the Gnostic Gospels. I read the Dalai Lama's lectures on Jesus. And I tried to read the Zohar of Kabbalah. Best of luck with that. But I was struck every time by how strange they felt, how unfamiliar. Not only the content, but the setting, the language, the styles. Some frustrated me. Thanks for having the books on the screen. Some of them were incomprehensible. Nothing was as I had expected. And I don't think I necessarily changed lots of my beliefs about things in a propositional sense, in terms of explaining what I believed. But something has changed as a result of this. And it was maybe illustrated by the fact that I've had two very rich conversations with Muslim taxi drivers, one in New York and one in London, who were amazed that I'd been trying to read the Quran. And they wanted to tell me a lot of things about their faith and what it meant to them. And they would never have engaged me in that conversation had I not tried to read their scripture. And so it's kind of opened a door. It's opened a door inside me, I think, and it's opened a door in the sort of dialogue that I can have. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I'm talking about in trying to engage broadly, widely. I'm not suggesting you want to replicate this, but there might be something else you want to do that broadens your horizons in the way that I feel like mine have been broadened. I suggest we just take 5 minutes on tables and just talk about, is there a new thing you tried that broadened your horizons? Or is there a new thing that you tried that made you feel uncomfortable? Maybe it's the same thing. Or if not, is there something you're meaning to try or you'd like to try that you think could have that effect? 5 minutes.
5 minutes later.
I can tell that something's been going on just because of the chatter. All right. Can we have the next clip, please? You have to be old to know what this is. Can't be a bit of Herbie. But there's a problem with all of this. And the problem is, if we start engaging in all these different sources, how do we cope? How do we cope with all the places we could go, all the different things on offer? So the brain uses schemas or frames in order to simplify its view of reality so that it can function, so we can function. And we also use something called heuristics or rules of thumb to cope with the massive flood of incoming information that we have all the time. That's a whole subject in itself. But it turns out that we also apply shortcuts to our sources of knowledge. And I just want to think about that for a minute. So the first type of simplification that we do, I'm going to call these simplifying strategies, is that we create isms and we create ologies and lots of other things that finish with letters but all mean the same thing. Essentially what we do is we take a bunch of sources and we blend them. We make them compatible with each other. And then we defend them. So we put a board around them. So, of course, the most obvious example is fundamentalism. Fundamentalism does exactly that. It packages a set of dogmas, a set of beliefs, and it therefore simplifies the whole business of trying to interact with sources, because the only debates you're left with are secondary debates, because the fundamentals have been taken care of. So we see it in religious fundamentalism of all types, but we also see it in scientism that I mentioned. We see it in some conspiracy theories. We see it in cults. It's a way of simplifying the whole business of interacting with sources of knowledge, because you package something up and that becomes the official source of knowledge, and then you're allowed to have secondary debates. But there's a big trade-off, and the trade-off, which many of us are very intimately familiar with, is firstly your beliefs are not derived from your experience. There's oversimplification, there's groupthink, there's suppressions of questions and alternative views, and there's often an in or out mentality that arises. So that's one simplification strategy. I would suggest that the trade-off is pretty big. The second type, and these are just examples, is what I would call single issue activism. So in this approach, you take one thing and you elevate it over everything else so that everything else is less important and subordinated to it. And you look at everything through one lens. So, an example, Just Stop Oil, Scottish Independence, Stonewall. By the way, I'm not saying that these are bad organizations. I'm saying that essentially they've picked a subject that people are passionate about, but it's the lens through which they look at the world. Of course, the danger with this kind of thing is that the hyper-focus creates a trench, that other issues that are very important are subordinated or neglected, and that people with different priorities are demonized. So everyone's doing some kind of simplification of sources. It's just some of it's conscious and some of it's unconscious. And I thought I'd just tell you mine, because I've been reflecting on it and trying to work out what it is. I would call mine the emergent quest. So what I've done, I've limited my interaction with sources of knowledge to the things that are happening in my life. And so I'm allowing my life experience to determine the things that I then try and find out about. So whether it's preparing talks here, or it's something that's happened, or it's a question someone asks me, I'm finding that a good way not to collapse into the chasm of my own curiosity. And interestingly, if you look at the New Testament, I think we find Jesus doing this. Jesus' teaching is mostly out of the context of what was happening. This is what newspaper columnists do. They comment on whatever is emerging in the world. In fact, many artists do the same. They paint the landscapes that are around them. Sometimes we found out recently at some impressionist experience that we went to in Canada, sometimes it's their own garden. Of course, we have these pictures and we have no idea that this was right on the doorstep of the artist. So the trade-off is of this one is many important things don't get looked at. And of course, who's to say that the things emerging in your own life are the most important in the grand scheme of things? It's also very difficult to try and keep everything else in some kind of equilibrium while you do it and not to get sidetracked into something else. But that's what I've realized I'm doing to cope with all the potential things that we could be looking at. The Dalai Lama, it was very interesting in his lecture, he suggests that everyone should stay in their own religious context, whatever it is, and to pursue their spiritual journey from there to avoid this exact problem of overload and not knowing where to go, which I thought was really interesting. It's Easter. A year ago, I did the whole thing on Jesus, but I'm going to have a Jesus moment, because I'm going to suggest to you that Jesus is actually God's simplification strategy as understood by Christianity. So, incarnation, by which God becomes a person, actually exists in a number of religions. And I now know this in a new way, because Krishna in the Gita is also an incarnation of God and is talking in that particular scripture with someone in order to get a sense of dialogue. But Christianity has incarnation right at the center. And these are a few words from John 1, the start. The Word was God. The Word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. No one's ever seen God, not so much as a glimpse. But this one-of-a-kind God expression, who exists at the very heart of the Father, has made him as plain as day. That's the message in case you were thinking it was not the King James Version. So the word is logos, and logos was a familiar philosophical term which Philo, one of the philosophers of the day, called the idea of ideas. It was essentially the organizing principle of all reality. In Christianity, it's not an abstract thing, it's part of God, the second person of the Trinity, aka Jesus. And John says that Jesus, the Logos, the idea of all ideas, the principle holding all reality together, became a human. Now that's a very, very big exercise in simplification, because suddenly this idea of all reality is just like one of us. But much easier to grasp as a result, because our brains are literally wired to understand one another. We have whole segments of our brain that are tuned in to other people. And it says that through doing this, Jesus made God as plain as day. So, whatever you believe, it's a very interesting idea that even in a religious context, simplification strategies are at work and may be necessary because some thoughts are just too big for us to grasp, and they need to be simplified and illustrated in different ways. Can we have the cat? Thank you. So let me conclude. Today I've argued that there's an inexhaustible array of sources of knowledge to satisfy, or actually more likely fuel, our curiosity. And I've suggested we should engage with them directly, critically, diversely, and together. I've also argued that increasing the range of our sources is good for us, even though it takes effort and it can make us uncomfortable. But we need ways of managing the complexity. I've explained how I do it. You'll have your own way, but you will need a way to avoid just dropping into some kind of overload situation. But whatever you choose to do, I think it's a good day to celebrate becoming curiouser and curiouser, because whatever the quest is about, the process of the quest that I talked about last time, the different things we interact with that I've tried to talk about this time, whatever is true about all of that, I celebrate and I hope we all value this journey of becoming more curious that we're on. And I do hope that it continues as we become curiouser and curiouser, and don't worry too much about good English. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another Q York podcast. Now, if you've enjoyed what you've heard today, then we would love to hear from you. Feel free to drop us an email to info@qyork.co.uk and let us know who you are and where you're listening from. Don't forget there are blogs and all sorts of media to be enjoyed at qyork.co.uk, which you're welcome to browse at your leisure. Until next time, enjoy the quest.